Today, unscrambling the macroeconomic omelette.
So today, I have a special treat. I have two well-known people who are absolutely on top of their game in the studio with me. Welcome, guys.
Thanks, Martin. Thanks for having us.
So do introduce yourselves first. I'm sure people will know, but start with you.
Yeah, sure. So Damien Klassen back again. So we are on the Nucleus Wealth investment funds, and we're partnered with Walk the World for providing super and non-super products.
And David Llewellyn Smith, I blog as Houses and Holes at Macro Business, and also function as the strategist at Nucleus Wealth and the funds.
Mm. And it's interesting because, of course, there's also the Walk the World Fund that Damien runs for me. So there's an interesting connectivity and synergy here. But what's interesting is we actually quite often share some very common views about some of the issues facing the economy right at the moment. And perhaps not necessarily totally mainstream views, but really very important views. And I thought it might be good just to explore a few of those thematics at the moment, right, as we come in towards the end of 2021 and into 2022, because there look to me to be some choppy waters ahead.
And I think that's right. I would say probably the views in this room are quite out of step with the mainstream at the moment, Martin. Mm. In particular, you know, there's a lot of debates in the press and in the markets about the return and rise of inflation. Which, of course, comes with the implication of rising interest rates as well. And we've seen some of that in Australia recently, just with markets breaking the RBA in two over its knee for fixed-term rates and things. But our view is that markets are pretty out of step with what's coming for the Australian economy. Like, we think that the supply side stuff globally will probably ease, and more importantly here, we've got the resumption of mass immigration, and you know, the fixed rate bust that we've already seen is likely to slow housing, and so we think that Australian inflation will lag a lot and interest rates here will really struggle to rise at all.
And the slowdown in Chinese housing.
Of course, yes. Mm. Commodity prices have already fallen a lot and will keep doing so.
So it's sort of, to me, it's this quandary about going, okay, everyone, I think politically would like things just to jump back to where they used to be and go, okay, everything's, you know, we're back to where it was. Mm. And for us, it's now trying to work out which of the elements will jump back to where it was. And so as you spoke about immigration. So, I mean, there is still a question mark, will the people come? So you can build it, but will they come? And probably, but, you know, we don't know for sure. That's one worth watching. But at the same time, some of the change. So we do think there are some of the changes, especially in terms of, say, Chinese property, where it does look like they're quite serious about this. And in terms of returning to the history, is yes, returning to the history, but it's the history that they had in, say, 2015, where there was quite a concerted slowdown. And then the question about, you know, will they decide to reopen the debt taps and come roaring out of that again? Probably not. I mean, again, there are some questions, but yeah, I think it's.
So one of my interesting observations, it seems to me that the market is reading the economy very differently from the way that we're reading it. I mean, they're saying rates are going to rise and they're going to rise quite quickly. I guess they're looking at you know, the US and inflation and all that sort of stuff. But the question is, are they really right, or are they actually missing the important point, which is actually economic momentum probably is going to be really tough to drive from this point forward. The you know, iron ore price and other you know, the stuff we sell overseas not necessarily going to work as well, and even locally the economy here locally is not firing that well.
Look, I think next year's will be okay. Mm. Like, there's enough sort of tail on the stimulus
right
from COVID, but it's definitely on a flight path down, and I would expect as the year goes on for it to get more difficult, basically. I mean, we do have lots of momentum in the labour market and other things, you know, that if they were left to develop, might actually give us back some positive inflation. Mm. In wages growth. Probably would, in fact. Australian unions are probably stronger still than some of the other Anglosphere countries if they were left to their own devices, but of course they won't be, and it won't matter who's in power either. And this is where the immigration model becomes really important, because it's just a permanent supply shock in the labour market, and it just kills wages growth. And it took us 10 years to beat this sense into the RBA, and we finally did, and so at least now that whole debate has been taken out of the realms of culture wars and racism and all that kind of foolishness, and now it's an economic story. But it's one that the major parties in Canberra simply won't canvass change to. So, you know, that's a critical element in seeing Australian inflation as diverging. And, you know, the housing market's actually in a bit of a shock right now from fixed rates. I mean, they're on the fixed rate mortgages from the term funding facility and yield curve control that the market's just broke. You know, they were very central to this tearaway boom we've had. So that, I think, is going to come off fast. Not necessarily price falls, but I think growth is in trouble. And then the commodity price story, as Damo says, like, that really does look real this time. Like, where China, you know, we're in one of those strange kind of good news is bad news stories on that front, where if China makes an error in how they're trying to manage that adjustment, then we might get the flood stimulus and another round of commodity price boom. But if they manage it reasonably well, with the various offsets and stimulus they've got to counteract falling growth from diminishing property, then iron ore's in all sorts of pain for more or less ever from here. And not just iron ore, all the bulk commodities. And they could fall a lot more, even if we see, you know, some of the rising commodity prices in base metals and stuff that's attached to the environmental story, lithium and whatever, and they would completely swamp all of that anyway. And so you could still have a reasonably robust commodity outlook globally, and yet Australia's would be very poor. And so, yeah, all of those kind of tip into, well, the way we're seeing it, MB, is basically we're sowing the seeds of another lost decade, Martin, you know, which is what we did in 2012. And it looks very, very similar, you know.
So one of the things I think about is underinvestment in businesses and in the future, right? The capital numbers weren't great. They weren't, you know, too bad. But
look, they were pretty good. But but the issue is, like, it took an enormous amount of stimulus to get them to be pretty good. And most of it isn't great CapEx anyway. You know, it's more your new ute and tools and what have you. But if you're quite right in that, if you look at capital investment as a percentage of Australian GDP, it's like 60-year lows.
And what about the mix of bank lending to housing versus to business? Because that has completely switched over the last 20 years, hasn't it?
Yeah. Well, we all know that that story. Any number of different drivers to it, and there's no end in sight. No, I mean, there's simply no will in Canberra to shift it. And then, of course, you know, the power of the banks to lobby, etc.
Can I add one more thing into the? Let's say we didn't have everyone come back on the population side, or it's below expectations, saying, okay, well, is there potential for some wage growth there? And you go, yeah, maybe if that happens. But so it's sort of like one side of, you know, maybe we haven't got quite enough and people are more concerned about lifestyle and so maybe they demand higher wage rise. So that's on one side. But the flip side, you can also have a case, and I'm not quite sure which one comes out, where people are actually saying, you know what, life's too short. I actually want lifestyle now. I don't care about it. And someone says, well, you have an extra $5,000 if you come back in the office? And they go, No, I'll take a $5,000 pay cut to have, you know, another couple of days at home, or to be able to work from Noosa, or, you know, or something like that. And if that's the case, then there's actually a productivity loss in terms of you have to hire a few more employees to do the same job. Wages, while the aggregate wage bill for Australia might be going up, the individual wages for people aren't going up. They actually might even be falling a bit. And so maybe there's actually a demand drop off. And I'm not saying this is a base case, but I'm saying, well, that's a relatively realistic scenario. And I look at a lot of the, there's some weird surveys coming out now about, in particular, millennials, you know, just not getting job satisfaction. And it's, this isn't a pandemic thing. This is the last 6 months. It's sort of the and so that, and that's the ones I just worry about, saying, I don't actually know what that means. Does that mean we end up in this low demand, lower wages part where people just don't want to work as much? And it's productivity sucking, or does it mean that no, you just need to raise wages faster, and it's actually a demand boom for people with higher wages?
Except that if you lift wages, then that's going to put pressure on prices, and that's going to then potentially dampen demand and all of those things, right?
Yeah.
So there's some interesting feedback loops there. The other feedback loop that I'm interested in is the exchange rate, right? Because if in fact around the world other central banks start to lift rates, and they probably should, and we don't, what does that do to the exchange rate?
Well, it's going to fall.
Mm.
It's certainly central to our outlook.
Yeah.
And that's, there's lots of different inputs into the value of a currency, but the two big ones for Australia are the interest rate spread, like the difference between our rates and elsewhere, and commodity prices, because they really determine national income and thereby wages and inflation, et cetera. So the two interact. And we obviously think the commodity story is weak, and then you throw in the fact that inflation is very strong in the US and some other jurisdictions, but it's largely a US story still. Then you get a powerfully rising US dollar, while you have, you know, a whipping boy Australian dollar. And so you could get some pretty dramatic moves down in the Australian dollar, yes, if that plays out, for sure.
And would the Reserve Bank like a weaker dollar?
Yes, they would.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think that, but probably in their heart, they'd probably prefer they didn't have to blow a housing bubble to get there as I think if...
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so you've just touched on the other thing, Damon, which is APRA. You know, everyone's saying, well, APRA is going to actually have to do macroprudential to try and calm the housing market. Do you think it might actually just do it on its own?
Well, at the moment, we're in danger of becoming pro-cyclical.
Yeah.
Because they've all been taken by surprise by the trashing of their yield curve control, which I think homeowners should probably be pretty annoyed about, to be honest. I mean, we don't have an inflation problem. We know sure as hell don't have any inflation in our wages. And yet the RBA has just rolled over and let the market determine short-term interest rates without putting up the remotest of fights, whilst it's promising homeowners to keep rates low till 2024. I mean, that seems to me at best to have pointed out some flaws in its forward guidance policy settings that really need, you know, some examination. But APRA is now tightening as well, as this unexpected yield curve collapse has happened. And so, you know, I actually think house prices are going to flatten out really fast.
Yeah.
And one of the surprises next year might be APRA actually backflipping.
Yeah.
And I don't think we'll see the RBA forced to print or anything yet, unless the commodity prices really crater. But I could see APRA, a circumstance where APRA actually is forced to loosen by the end of the year, say, because they are acting pro-cyclically, because they've lost control of their short-term interest rates.
So thinking about APRA and the Reserve Bank, right, and the dancing they've been doing, people have been suggesting that maybe there's a need to ask some harder questions of particularly the RBA and probably APRA too. Now, I know Phil Lowe's come back and said, well, we'll probably look at yield curve control and we might look at the term funding facility, right, which is, to my mind, a misdirection of the question that should be asked. Do we need a fundamental review of the RBA and its role and its function, do you think?
Well, we absolutely do in theory.
Yeah.
But as we discussed before on camera, is there much point when you have a banking royal commission with the outcomes that we did? These inquiries just sort of fall into a void. But yes, we do. And the structure of Australian monetary policy is completely broken.
Yeah.
You know, we don't know who's setting it. The RBA is only half in control. APRA's half in control. You know, the appointments of senior staff. I run through the treasurer, who, you know, for instance, the chairman of APRA was reappointed in the middle of the Banking Royal Commission, which was destroying his credibility as he was reappointed. And it was like, you know, where's the accountability in this system? You know, there's diffused responsibility between the two in macroprudential and the, you know, the cost of money versus the distribution of money, and it's a mess. Now, they manage it through the Council of Financial Regulators, as we know, but that's diffused responsibility too. So nobody's accountable for anything. And, you know, perhaps you could argue that's why we ended up with a yield curve control setting that just got smashed at the first sign of trouble. It's not robust, the way it's operating.
And when I can't think of when the last time we had an external appointment from, you know, another central bank from somewhere else around the world
that. That's right.
There was,
well, we've often argued, I mean, the RBNZ's made a bit of a hash of things over the last few years, but we used to argue we should get a few of those cats in just to shake it up, because they did have stronger kind of intellectual credibility over the last few decades.
Well, and also just the part, regardless of even if you are doing a good job, you want people to challenge your views, and if you've basically brought people up and said, this is a way we teach everyone to think at this, and now you're the leader, and it's actually saying, well, let's
get like, by all accounts, they're both incredibly defensive organisations, like intellectually closed, politicised. I guess I would more, not necessarily politicised in the sense of national politics, but politicised in terms of office politics.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, and they have a narrow ideology, don't they? They have a narrow ideology about what works and what doesn't work and what they can and what they can't do and how they operate.
Look, it has started to sort of loosen up a little because they spent 10 years missing their target, right? And so they eventually realised, well, maybe we're doing something wrong. But yeah, I mean, just about everybody I know who comes out of there, and there's a lot of people who go through these organisations and then into the private system, economists, etc., analysts, they all say the same thing, that ideas are not at a premium in there.
Okay, last question before we close. There's an election coming probably sometime next year, right? Is that going to make any difference at all?
To what, Martin? not a lot, no. I mean, not a lot in terms of what we're talking about here, the macroeconomics of the economy. The Labor has a slightly more hawkish view on immigration, but it's really, we're debating visa categories rather than actually shifting it, trying to shift it away from the impacts on the labor market that it's having. And, you know, they're more or less going to be elected on a zero platform. Like, we don't really know what Labor wants to do. And that might be a clever political strategy. I think it is, because Morrison's on the nose. So make him the issue. That might get them elected, but it gives them zero.
But the Liberals don't have a policy either.
Well, they don't, no. So inertia.
Two parties with neither of them who are suggesting anything really, except vote me in and let us be in charge.
I don't expect any reform. I mean, we probably will see an inquiry into the RBA, but how high powered it is questionable. And then, of course, if anyone actually listens is the second question.
Right, and that's what I was going to sort of say, that it seems to me that the political processes in Australia are designed to not make a difference.
Yes.
Right. We go through the motions, we go through the processes, we have the elections, you know, we have the Reserve Bank saying this and that and the other. But actually, at the end of the day, the fundamental issues that should be being tackled and addressed to build a future for Australians is not being addressed.
No.
We'll build a list, though. The same as we've had a housing inquiry. God knows how many housing inquiries. They build the list and we know what to do and we don't do any of it. We had a Banking Royal Commission and we build a list and we say we're going to do everything. Yes, we're going to tick them all off, but we don't.
We have an affordability inquiry right now, don't we? Which even most of those who are inside the tent are pissing on.
Exactly. Like is this the Australian disease, or is this a broader disease, do you think?
Well, I think you can see it at work in other jurisdictions. Yeah. I mean, places like the US have policy paralysis that's similar. But I do think perhaps, you know, that there are peculiarities to it that are Australian. I mean, we could go on a long time about this, but probably the key one is just China, the rise of China and the commodity boom made life really easy, and bad policy looked like good policy. But, you know, the reverse of that is now, as things get tougher, then bad policy will look like terrible policy, which is why what's happened over the last decade we've just had, and why we had such churn in our prime ministers, because, you know, they're of a culture that can't cope with the need for real reform. And so they fail, and they're booted, and then we end up with, you know, the likes of ScoMo.
So the thing that I'm always wrestling with is there is clearly a case for reform. There is a case to do things differently, right?
Oh, yes.
And yet it just doesn't seem to translate into outcomes of elections or outcomes of policymakers or outcomes from regulators. Everybody's just dancing the old tune. So how do we get the new tune started?
Well, that's no
revolution.
That's no small question, Matt. yeah, well, I mean, you probably... It's very difficult to mobilise something in such a bourgeois, comfortable kind of state.
Right.
Even though we have our inequalities and they're getting worse, etc. You know, I'm not sure we're capable of actually changing it without some kind of external stimulus or shock.
Okay. So we need a crisis.
We probably do need a crisis.
Right.
But we've had crises, and we've, what we've always done is just supported the existing system.
Can I point you in I want you to keep going. David often talks about things that China's doing that actually help Australia achieve the right solution without actually... So maybe I think that might be...
Well, we could rely on Beijing to fix it for us, Martin. Right. I mean, that's what we've done most of the time. We needed to diversify our trade away from China, and so Beijing has started doing that for us. we haven't done a damn thing. And of course, we had the foreign investor housing bubble from sort of 2015 through 18 or 14 through 18, and it was Beijing that resolved that problem for us as well. They shut their capital account. We were happy to take the bribe as far as it was going to go. I mean, that's all a bit of a joke, but China is one possible stimulus for it. Insofar as, you know, they're not the good global citizen that everyone was counting on.
But part of it might be if our iron ore revenue dries up and our coal revenue dries up and our gas revenue dries up, then all of a sudden maybe a few people actually need to take us. What other industries could we actually...
Right.
Well, I think we'll go back to the term funding facility at that point. But that's not necessarily a bad thing. Like, the thing is, the tools are all there.
Yes.
It'd be great to have a term funding facility if you also had a harsh macroprudential.
Yeah.
At the time, because what you're going to do is trash your currency without blowing a housing bubble, and so then you can start to rebuild your tradable sectors and stuff. So the answers are all there, but somehow wrestling with this bag of cats of interests that have just taken over is extremely difficult to dislodge.
And I think that's really, really important to end with, because the tools are there, the components to do things differently are there, right? It actually becomes a political will question.
Absolutely.
Right? Not an economic skill question.
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we may see the rise of a sensible new party somewhere. You know, sadly, at the moment, we're getting the rise of a loon party. There's obviously a lot of anger in the community after COVID, quite naturally, that needs an outlet. That is a febrile environment where you could get change, but sadly in Australia that tends to take us to our default populism rather than some... Because we're quite anti-intellectual as a nation and suspicious of ideas. And so it's going to take something, you know, pretty special to sort of rise up and change it. I mean, I think Labor of the kind of 80s is maybe a paradigm for it, but... But that was very circumstantial, and you know, a bunch of extraordinary people happened to come together. But that's the sort of thing we're going to need.
Well, guys, I really appreciate your time today, and thanks for coming and visiting me in the studio here and seeing what we do. And you know, some of those thematics I wouldn't mind picking up down the track, because I think there are some really, really important points here in terms of thinking differently about the problem, right? Because there are solutions out there, right? And I'm not prepared to just roll over and say it's too hard, right? Because there are things we could be doing.
Oh, absolutely. There are. There's probably like a big five ideas that would radically change the direction of the economy and country.
Right.
You know, but they all face the same problem. They're those that it will cost have the ear of Canberra.
Well, maybe we should do a show subsequent on the big five ideas, because I think that would be a really interesting conversation to have. Guys, thanks very much.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Martin.